As Nikki Atchehoff-Gray of Sirius Eats writes, Thanksgiving is, if anything, an immigrant's holiday, a story of the bridging of new world and old. So it's fitting that, like people, Thanksgiving traditions themselves continue to migrate and evolve. One thing that made the journey to America's shores is wine. So today we'd like to hear from you on what dishes your immigrant experience has are now served at your Thanksgiving table. And here to help us understand the immigration of wine is Master of Wine and Master Sommelier Doug Frost. Doug, welcome back.
Hi, Danny. How's it going?
It's going really well. I'm going to ask you to open your first selection here while I invite our listeners to join in. We want to hear what foods from your immigrant history show up on your holiday table. Is it empanadas or roast lamb or moussaka? Whatever it is, we'd like you to share it with us. Tweet us at KCRUpToDate or call 816-235-2888. And Doug, what's our first selection here? What are we starting off with this morning?
Well, you know, it really is that when we talk about Thanksgiving, we're talking about an internationally and traditional and historical moment when people give thanks, quite, you know, obviously literally, for what has taken place for the harvest and for hopefully a bountiful harvest. So while we celebrated, and ever since George Washington, you know, decided to codify this thing, we celebrated on a late in November, and we connect it to the arrival of the pilgrims and that particular moment when our two civilizations came together. That's to say that the first peoples of this continent and the Europeans. It was probably one of the last times we came together in a peaceable manner, but nonetheless, it is that we, you know, it's this clash of cultures that I think is partly about celebrating thanks, partly about, as some people have made it, sort of a religious holiday now. When you look around the world, there's all sorts of cultural and even, I think, animistic, you know, sort of pagan beliefs that are associated with what needs to happen at this point in time. And then finally, you know, if it strikes a chord with those who think about Christmas, the commercial side. So with all that as the background, I brought Beaujolais Nouveau. I mean, Beaujolais Nouveau is like, I know, Beaujolais Nouveau, okay, it's a French wine, and it is the harvest wine. It's a wine mm-hmm. that it represents the first stuff off the fermenter. But at the same time, I would openly admit, you know, it's not a wine that has a great tradition. The tradition of Beaujolais Nouveau dates back to about the 1950s.
It has a great tradition for me. It's like I date the calendar. We used to go to a local area, Booze Fish that's no longer open, mm-hmm. and they would always. It was kind of like a rite of the holiday or of the season to go down for the Beaujolais Nouveau and always have it. And it was, I love it. I think it's a fun wine. And I'm going to encourage, I'll introduce you all in the morning, but our tasters to start tasting.
That's right. Don't wait for instructions.
That's
just
right.
Go.
Just start.
You can do this. So, of course, they're trying the Beaujolais Nouveau. This is Drouin's Beaujolais Nouveau. It is a wine that really does for anybody in the wine business, this is what wine tastes like right out of the fermenter. It is fun and fruity and vibrant and easygoing and easy drinking.
Now, you're going to take away all our descriptors if you keep going on like that.
Oh, sorry.
So, let's go around the table a little bit. I just want to introduce who's here, who volunteered for the tough duty of tasting today. Peggy Lowe is KCR's investigations editor and a reporter for Harvest Public Media, which is based here at the station. Peggy, thanks for coming in this morning.
Good morning.
Lisa Rodriguez is the associate producer of Up to Date, and she has had the honor of doing this before, so it wasn't hard to get her to come back. Good morning, Lisa.
And it is an honor. Good morning.
And David Polk is the director of philanthropic giving here at KCUR. David, thanks for joining us this morning.
Absolutely.
So let's go ahead and get an idea. I personally love this. This is very bright to me, and it's has that nice tartness that I like really, really well. Peggy, what are your thoughts on this?
I agree with you on the tartness, and I always think of Beaujolais as that wine you serve at Thanksgiving because it does go really well with food, and it doesn't take away from the food, and this one seems a bit better than most. Is that right?
I think Drouin is a very good name, and I like the way that you've described that because I do often think of food and wine interacting in that way that often I'll tell people, look, you know, either the food is the star or the wine is the star, but, you know, you don't put a couple divas up there and have them start,
right.
you know, bouncing each other
right.
off the stage. So, you know, instead, I like a wine like this when the food is really complex and interesting because the wine's just like, hey, I'm here as a beverage. You know, I'm just trying to wash food down. down. And it's a fun beverage, you know, but again, I'm giving too many descriptors.
And this would go with green bean casserole. Can I just add that?
I knew it was coming.
Peggy did an excellent piece this morning that played during Morning Edition on the green bean casserole, and coming from an area of the country where green bean casserole is not a tradition, the Northeast, it was one of those dishes that I learned about when I came out here. So, and if it was a green bean casserole, Doug, what would you pair with that?
Well, see, that's a very interesting question. Is it the crunchy? Do you get the crunchy little canned onions on
top?
Right.
And the little creaminess.
Very important. And then do you have the, you know, cream mushroom? So what I think about the whole thing is at that point you have this really kind of heavy dish, and let's be honest, or at least in my view, it's not a complex dish, it's just a heavy, thick kind of
comforting,
stick to your gut
creamy.
Stick to your gut kind of food. So I need a wine that has some backbone to it and that wants to cut through that. So I like taking wines that are very tart and rather intense in their tartness to put up against it. An easy find would be something like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. You put it up against the green beans. Now, the gross part about that, and I'd say the gross part, because I usually don't like taking the flavor of the food and matching it with the flavor of the wine. And New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc tastes or smells like, guess what? Green beans.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, or at least it often can. So I'd find one that's a little more citrusy in style and not super heavy, you know, one that's fresher. I want that tartness.
And if you're wondering how we got to this conversation up to date, this is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Danny Alexander. I'm in for Steve Kraske, and we're talking wines with Master of Wine, Doug Frost. So, Lisa, what were your thoughts on this?
The Beaujolais Nouveau, all I had to do was smell it, and it just brings back fond memories. It's my strawberry wine, and I worked for many years at a French bistro in Kansas City, and we always had a big party for Beaujolais Nouveau. So although I know it gets some hate from people, but I think it's fun, and for me it's about the experience, and I have always fond memories of the Beaujolais Nouveau.
And if there's one thing that this does show us, it's Doug's rule that if you like it, drink it, because this is a red wine, and normally I think a lot of people would not necessarily say to themselves, oh, red wine and my traditional Thanksgiving meal of turkey, but Doug, you always say?
I do. I think people should drink what they like and leave it at that. But the merit of this wine is that it's very fruity, but it's not sweet. It's like you said, it's tart. It's cranberry almost at the end.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh,
darn it.
Exactly.
But
well,
I think
you said it.
I'm not as familiar with Beaujolais Nouveau as the rest of you. But when I taste this, I think, you know, most people don't think about a red wine with poultry but there's a cranberryness to this, not in the taste, but in that tartness.
Mm-hmm.
And you can
mm-hmm.
see it right there with the turkey. So this is a great, great find for me.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's not that, I chose this because it tastes like cranberries. I chose it because it's fruity and it still has a tartness to it that makes the food, well, here's the idea, as crazy as this sounds, the idea is that the wine is supposed to give you an opportunity to taste the food again for the first time. You know, it is that we can point at a human physiological trait called adaptation, that once you've been smelling and tasting something for a long time, and that could be 90 seconds, the brain will begin to turn those aromas down because it wants you to be attuned to other aromas. The idea for me, a descriptor I always give, or the anecdote, is I used to work at a feedlot when I was 15. And, you know, it was really good money for a 15-year-old, but I would come home smelling special, you know, shall we say, after, you know,
that's
6 hours in the feedlot.
I used to work the barns.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, but when I would drive to, you know, I'd get a clean set of overalls and get in the Mustang and drive back to the, you know, to the feedlot the next afternoon. And on my way there, I'm like, oh, man, we're live today, you know. And then by the time I've been there for 20 minutes or something, it's like, what? You know, the brain's turned that off because the brain needs to know if there's a predator creeping up on me, or the brain needs to know if there's a fire that's coming over the hill. And if all I can smell is cow and cow produce, you know, I won't be able to smell that. So the same thing happens with a meal. It's why you have these different flavors on the table. If all you had was this turkey, by the seventh bite of the turkey, it's kind of boring because the brain's not feeding you any new information. So theoretically, you wash it down with a beverage, and it means the next time you take the bite of turkey, it's like the first bite again.
And can it be reversed? Can food enhance the what you're tasting in the wine?
That's certainly what we hope. At the same time, I always feel I have to deliver the message that the purpose of wine is to be a condiment to food. That there is a you know, with the newfound publicity around the sommelier position. There is, in my opinion, overemphasis upon people who choose wine. Really, all we're doing is we're good shoppers, you know what I mean? We're mm-hmm. not really creative people like chefs who actually put something together. And so I'm sort of frustrated with sommeliers who think that they're somehow the star of the show. The star of the show is the food. The person who makes the food is the chef. You are a condiment, you who bring wine to the table. And wine is just there to make food taste better.
Agreed. And for our listeners out there, if you have a question for Doug Frost, Master of Wine and Master Sommelier, he does it both, folks. Do give us a call here at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. So, the thunk of a bottle, one of my favorite sounds. So is there anything else that really compares to the Beaujolais in your mind, Doug?
Well, Beaujolais has a certain propensity to be super fruity and super easy and to kind of please everybody. But honestly, there are many other grapes that have that sort of intensity of flavor. The Beaujolais Nouveau, and all Beaujolais are made from a grape called Gamay. Mm-hmm. Gamay can be grown in other places and made into a similar wine. Often when Beaujolais is not made in a nouveau style, it's made in a more serious style, and it tastes very much like Pinot Noir, or seems very much like Pinot Noir, which also can be intensely fruity. Syrah can be intensely fruity red.
That was one of my questions, Doug. So I read recently that one of the best wines to pair with turkey is Pinot Noir. Is that true?
And see, actually, I'm not a Pinot Noir and turkey guy, although if that's what you want, you know, you do that. That's fine. I love Pinot Noir, but I do think that the foods on the Thanksgiving table, you know, if it were just turkey, I'd be like, yeah, let's do Pinot Noir all day long. But I feel like I need a little more weight and a little more intensity to it, because so many of the foods there have more weight and intensity. And in fact, a lot of the foods can be rather sweet. And that challenges things. So when it comes to my turkey dinner, full disclosure, I'm drinking German Riesling mm-hmm. all day long. I mean, I'll have like a Pinot Noir or a Syrah, or, you know, maybe the leftovers of my Beaujolais Nouveau for whoever wants it. But I'll be drinking German Riesling because, one, I love German Riesling, and two, I think it matches wonderfully with all the foods on the table. And really good German Riesling has a tartness to it that belies its reputation as a sweet wine. It can be made sweet, dry, and everything in between, and I tend to get those that are in between and finish really, really tart.
So in looking at our immigration story, when did Beaujolais make it over to here, roughly? I mean,
It's roughly an invention of the 1950s and 1960s, and it was invented really for the North American market. So it's a perfect example of an immigrant. I mean, it was absolutely, you know, if you will, somebody, a thing that said, well, I just can't make it here in my own land. I need to pick up and go elsewhere where I can become a stunning success, which is exactly what happened. And so I thought it was a sort of ironic example of how this happens. But the truth is that there's so much in the wine world, there's so much flow back and forth of ideas, grapes, and information that I thought this would be a fun example. But the next example comes at the question of immigration from an entirely different viewpoint.
And what is it that we have in front of us now?
Okay, this is a Texas wine. It's a Texas
wine. I'm sorry, did you just say Texas wine?
This is a Texas wine. Let's talk immigrants
here. Tell us the story, yeah.
Well, you know, the Texans are still convinced that we are the immigrants, and they were nice enough to let us join them back in, 19th century. But this particular wine has a really very interesting history. What I would explain to you is that the great heritage and the rather unspoken heritage of American wine, the immigrant that really matters is Spain. And the Spanish wine and the Spanish wine industry really was just built upon the monasteries, around the missions themselves. In fact, the dominant grape that was used for that time and still in existence today is called the mission grape. We don't know where precisely what that grape was before it arrived in America. It was a Spanish grape of some sort, but it changed as soon as it got to America. Hint, hint, you know, it's a perfect immigrant. It became something new and something different. And the mission grape found its way all the way to California. It was used to make a wine called Angelica, which was a super sweet, basically fortified wine that was the magical product of Los Angeles, the city of angels, Angelica. And it went extinct about 100 years ago, although you can still find bottles of it. And the wines are still alive. It's kind of amazing. But the mission grape gave rise to this movement, particularly in the Spanish part of the current United States, of trying to create new grapes that might survive. So this grape, talking about an immigrant, is the work of a guy named T.V. Munson. And T.V. Munson was, Thomas Volney Munson has a nice French Burgundian Pinot Noir name, middle name. And Munson himself started creating these grapes in Texas, east of Denison, created about 300 grapes. And this is one of the grapes he created, trying to hybridize grapes from Europe with grapes from America. The reason is because our landscape, our pests, our climate is not conducive to the grapes that were grown in Europe. The Chardonnays and the Cabernets and the Zinfandels, and all of those are generally speaking planted on American roots. That's how they're done around the world now, because we have a particular pest called phylloxera right. that chewed it all up in the mid-19th century. Well, so he made this Lamanto, it's called, in an attempt to create a grape that was all our own. So to change that immigrant into something that was our own. And I think this is a vineyard called Fairhaven. I think he makes more successful versions than this one. He just produced a new one that's really delicious, but I haven't gotten my hands on a sample yet. But I thought I'd let you try it anyway and see what you thought.
Well, have you all had a chance to try it?
I have, yeah. I think it's much like Texas. It's very flat and a little tasteless. I'm sorry. And if I just might add here for the sake of...
You know, you don't have to apologize to me, but the great state of Texas right now.
I know, huh? I might get messed with a little bit. But I would also suggest, though, if we're talking immigrants, my people are Irish, and I'm sure on Thanksgiving we'll be serving light beer.
Light beer?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it is kind of sad. I understand that Guinness has not been for some years the dominant beer in Ireland, but in fact, Miller Lite.
Oh, isn't that horrifying?
It is heartbreaking.
Yeah. And Lisa, what are your thoughts on this?
It's not my favorite, but it is interesting. It's got a really tart finish on mm-hmm, it, which I didn't expect. Mm-hmm. So I like trying new things, and I like trying interesting things, and this is something that I will try, and then probably move on to other exciting things.
Ooh, how diplomatic.
She is so diplomatic.
David?
Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah, I'm not going to try it, Lisa. It is tart now that I've had it. That is happening, but I tasted it just has the sediment kind of taste early on and just totally turned me off. But it does have a little fruitiness now that it's been a little while.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It does. I think truthfully, I'm incredibly enthusiastic about this set of grapes. There's about 100 of them still left alive. And in fact, there's a working just north of Kansas City with the name Vox Vineyard, who's doing a wonderful mm-hmm. job with a lot of these grapes. If I had a bottle of his Lamanto, I'd have been glad to bring it, and I think you'd elect it a little better. Like I said, this particular Lamanto, he's working on it. This is actually the first commercial bottle of this grape ever made. Cabernet's been around for 350 years. Pinot Noir's been around for 800 to 900 years. It takes a couple of tries to get it right. And what's important about these grapes is really this, that Texas in particular, but much of the Midwest really struggles to grow, as I said before, Chardonnay and Cabernet and the rest. In fact, I think it's nearly impossible to do so and to make great wine. I honestly believe these grapes that have been forgotten for 100 years are the key to the future of wine in this part of the United States.
And I was just going to say, I think this does have a future. I think it's very clean. I like it. It's as a palate cleanser almost. It works beautifully, actually. So yeah, I like it. It's bright. It's got that real tartness to it. And normally I'm not real fond of it when I have to unstick my tongue from the roof of my mouth, but this one I do like for it. What we're going to do is we'll continue our look at how the immigrant experience is reflected in our holiday feasts and the migration of wine to America. We'll get to our phone calls. Dale, hang on for us. But we need to take a short break. I'm Dani Alexander, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we are back. Hear Bob Marcus reflect on his 25 years at the Kansas City Area Development Council and the winner of the One in a Million Entrepreneurship Competition at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll ask local Islamic leaders How Islamic is the Islamic State? And the latest edition of State House Blend features two of the three Kansas Republicans booted off the House Health and Human Services Committee, so that's going to be worth a listen as well. But right now, this hour, we are joined by Master Sommelier, Master of Wine, Doug Frost, as we look at the immigration story of some wines and other beverages, I'm guessing, Doug, here to the United States. And before we go any further, I do want to get to Dale as promised, so... Dale, there we go. Go ahead. You're from Casey, Kansas, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And what's your question for Doug Frost today?
My question for Doug is that I like Rieslings, and then I happen to like one of the Moscatos done by Anotria, but I'm looking for a red wine, mildly sweet, and most reds just don't, frankly, do it for me.
Understood. You know, there is an incredible movement right now, an incredibly powerful movement, I should say, towards sweet red blends. And it's the funny part about it is it's the sweetness that dare not speak its name. Literally, brands like Apothic will not say on the label, or Ménage à Trois, don't say on the label sweet. They don't say fruity, none of that. And they are. And that's what makes them incredibly popular. And yet nobody wants to admit it. It's really, really weird to me. But I would just say in a nutshell, look for Apothic, look for Ménage à Trois, check out a couple of them, see what you think. But you know, the tradition of sweet red wine is old and venerated, frankly. And we live in a world in which, you know, if you drink red wine, you're not supposed to drink sweet. And it's just one of those stupid rules that you should just drink what you like. I don't know, you know, precisely why we got so stuck on that, but there you go.
Is it St. James Winery I'm thinking of that does a really nice red that has some sweetness to
St. James does one called Friendship School.
That's it.
It is delicious. And it is, frankly, you know, has some nice sweet, rich fruitiness to it. Thank you, Danny, for remembering that.
That's
one.
Okay, Dale. Hope that helps you out. Thanks for the call.
I've had some sweet red, some red Moscatos that have been really fun as well.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the big brands make those.
Doug, why are labels seemingly misleading?
It's a great question. And when I asked Gallo that, you know, the folks at Gallo, the answer I got was more or less a little, you know, wink and a nod, and because we know what we're doing. And, you know, the answer, I think, therefore, is that people, as we've said in the wine business for many years, people drink sweet and talk dry, that it simply is that people don't want to be confronted with so often with what it is they really like. And I think that's completely wrongheaded. I think that what the wine industry needs is transparency and openness. And I think that would be good for everybody. So I rail against it, but, you know, it doesn't matter what I think. So that's for sure.
So what is up next on our tasting table?
You know, why don't we have ourselves a little bit of cider? Mm. And the reason we're having cider is because...
Had that glass out so...
She is. She is
Did you hear
ready.
That go by?
That's right. The reason we're having cider is the wassail pun. Now, I know I'm moving through the holidays here and to be talking about wassailing, but wassailing is a tradition that may be close to 2,000 years old. We don't precisely know how old it is, but wassailing in its earliest iteration, we believe, was centered around the notion of tree worship. It was pre-Christian, in other words. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that you would go and you would perform rites in amongst the apple trees and the other produce trees, but primarily the apple trees. And or at least that's the information that we've been able to
Here
to
we come, a wassailing I was just among thinking the leaves so green.
Yeah. Thank you. Very kindly, David. Exactly that. And so people would go and they would, if you will, pay homage to the trees in hopes of having a bountiful harvest next year. That turned into a party. That turned into now we who work on the as vassals on the great estate go and ask the master of the estate to bless us as well, to share a bountiful harvest or to share the hopes for a bountiful harvest, which, again, was a party and well, to this day, you know, we still wassail, but in a completely different way. And I think cider is at the heart of it. Cider, if you get out of the Mediterranean Europe and Mediterranean Africa and the Near East and the Middle East, you leave the land in which wine made from grapes is a likely option. As you go north, you have to look at things like cider and beer. And cider, as I say, has this direct lineage to the wassailing.
So what is the process? How is this made?
Well, cider's pretty simple. You get lots of different grapes, lots of different apples together. In French tradition, you might even throw some pears in there as well. But you use what are called, you use apples that you wouldn't normally eat. Now, a lot of what we see in the U.S. are apples or ciders that are made from apples that we're well familiar with. But in the tradition, you know, when Johnny Appleseed was spreading all those apple seeds everywhere, it's important to understand he was spreading them by seed. When you spread apples by seed, you're not spreading the apples that we eat, the Romes and the Delicious and the Macintosh and all that stuff. Is done through those are not propagated through seed. So due to the fact that he was planting seeds, and he was quite open about this, he was trying to encourage people to drink cider. Drinking cider was, in his opinion, how one becomes closer to God, how one celebrates God's bountiful harvest. He believed that cider was very important to a healthy nation, to our health, our mental health, our physical health, and so he was trying to encourage America, drink more cider. So it's not the Johnny Appleseed in your school books, okay? That's not who the guy was.
So you take apples, and you simply do what with them? Squish them, take the
juice? Grind them up really well, depending upon how much water is in there, how sweet they are. But typically, we don't use solely sweet apples. Mm-hmm. We use spitters is the term we use. But they're sour, they're sweet, and they're bitter. And you use a mix of all those. And you let it ferment. It could be a wild fermentation. Or in the case of this one, it's a fermentation. You just add yeast, typical commercial yeast. Create a fermentation. Filter it to get all the gooey stuff out of there, and then let it sit usually for 3 to 6 months or so to settle, get a little more complex, drop it in a bottle and sell it. That's really it.
So, and I have to admit that you can taste the apple. You definitely can taste the apple, but I actually had the, for some reason, I expected this to be a little heartier. And it's a little, to me, one note. I don't even, I know you say let it get more complex as it ages, but I'm not tasting the different apples there, so.
I have another cider for you who need complexity. For some people, they just want refreshingness.
Which this has.
Yeah. I honestly think that a lot of the ciders that are in the market right now are pretty darn boring. And this is Sam Smith. It's not boring to me, but it is also commercial in the sense that it's refreshing. It's easy to take down.
And it's not overly sweet.
Yeah, it is
the
definitely not overly sweet.
The finish on it is definitely on the non-sweet side, which I kind of appreciate. David, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'm loving that. I see it's a product of the UK, but the finish on this just totally takes me back to the Hall and Vaughan orchards in Weston and those Jonathan apples, and where I grew up. And I prefer a little bit more of a tang in my. I do love ciders, and this one is more sweet, but it's not overly, and it's got a great finish for me. I'm loving it.
I thought this was really, really good, and I'm not a cider person at all, and I've really kind of gone away from beer. This would be wonderful to serve, I think, before your dinner because it's light, and it's a little bubbly, almost Prosecco-y, I thought. And you're right. The finish is kind of sweet, and I think it's lovely.
Lisa?
I liked it, and I would definitely drink it. But I'm the kind of person that I want something that's funky and stinky and something that most people would scrunch their noses at. That's exactly what I want to drink.
Oh, we got that for you. We're ready for you, Lisa.
But food-wise, I could see this. I mean, as if you're looking for something that's going to balance something that is maybe extremely rich or unctuous, I could see this being a real nice playoff, opposite of that. But I like your idea of serving it as more of an aperitif, perhaps, than during the meal. But
the bottle suggests cream soups and pork dishes.
See?
So your broccoli cream soup.
And I'll throw one other out there. You know, when we go back to Thanksgiving, the original Thanksgiving really looked like, there was unlikely to be any turkey, although wild game, wild fowl probably there, but seafood. There was a great deal. The Wampanoags and the Massasoits were seafood hunters. They had cod, they had lobster, they had mussels, they had scallops. It was probably a seafood. And in fact, we do believe that they had mussels with a kind of corn paste, that was something they were serving. And cider would have been something that they would have been trying to make as well.
Well, when I was researching, not to interrupt, but I was researching, because it's interesting, I was researching this through the Smithsonian site, and there's only two surviving documents that even mention what could have been there. Venison, for sure, because the Native American brought 5 deer to the feast. Wild fowl, which most people would assume, because they did note that turkey was plentiful in in the area. Seafood is what the culinary historians have said. But what was surprising, they said more than likely there was no alcohol there because they had only grown a few acres of barley and harvested it, and they would not have had the time to make beer.
They could make it pretty quick. They make it pretty quick and down and dirty. They knew how to make cider as well. So it's hard to say with certainty. The thing to note is they were strong believers that alcohol beverage was something that, you know, was a gift from God, and it was something that kept you healthy. You think back to those days, water is not as it's not as trustworthy. And so in biblical times, when people drank water mixed with wine, it's not to water down the wine, it's to make the water safe to drink. So what we think is very likely is it was a kind of cider. We know, as you say, that they were short on beer because in the captain's log, it says our victuals being spent, especially our beer. That's why we landed at Plymouth Rock in the first place. And one other funny connection, I almost thought about making a gin punch here because Plymouth, it is named after the place from whence they departed. And the night before the pilgrims left, they stayed at Blackfriars Distillery, which still to this day is a working distillery. And that is from, and has been from for centuries. Now, I was thinking about making a gin punch, which always includes the five ingredients, which are, you know, sweet, sour, basically spicy, water, and then alcohol. Water in the form of ice in our cocktail language, but water, just water, back in those days. And that was a very common drink. And we call it punch because it was originally invented by immigrants from Britain into India. In India, it was called punch. Barsi, that's five ingredients. And so it was the drink that had five. It was gin with five. So gin, anyway, and it connects to the pilgrims. It's all about, we're all immigrants, people.
So this selection that we have, and this is amazing because I lit up. David's kind of scrunching up his nose a little bit. And this is another cider or cedar, right, as they would say. And this is
Cidre.
And this is where I learn all my French. but this is from France, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so David and I have both made our faces. Mine of delight. David's questioning. These two have remained a little neutral. So, Lisa.
I'm a happy lady with this one. I feel like this maybe sound gross to some people. I feel like there's almost a little like blue cheese sort of a stinky taste in there.
Yep.
And to me, that puts a smile on my face.
And Peggy, this is great
because we have
opposites. Peggy, you're
I know every year it's
face.
Like Lisa shows her good taste in wine and other things, and I show my bad taste perhaps. But it was sweet. It was stinky. It was kind of thick.
Yum.
I don't taste the apple in it.
Really?
There's almost a medicinal taste to it to me.
Yes, I agree.
It's stinky.
And I'm trying to figure out what that is in there. I mean,
again, imagine now that we're apples. We're having very sour apples. We're having very bitter apples.
Soft, mushy apples.
You can
feel
kind of the bitter bite of this as well. And it's unusually sweet for a French cider. Most of them are powerfully sour. So I thought I brought it as a kind of in-betweener. But it is totally cool and appropriate that they're switching back to the Sam Smith.
David and I are going back to the first one.
Yeah, Lisa and Danny and I are going.
And thank heavens it's organic.
You wanted funky, Lisa.
I do. I love the funk.
I just want to remind our listeners, if they want to try some of these for themselves, we'll have a complete listing of all the beverages we've tasted today on our website, and that is at kcur.org. Just go to the up-to-date page. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Danny Alexander in for Steve Kraske, who just happened to be away, and I offered to step in for the toughest show of the year.
Too bad.
So sad. So we're talking wines with Master of Wine, Doug Frost. We're into, say it in French again for me, Cidre. Which is this French. And I'm sorry, who is the...
The producer is Lebrun, L-E-B-R-U-N. It's actually made by a Calvados producer called Domaine Bigou. And so Bigou has their own label, and you can find that out there. And you can also find this Lebrun label, which tends to be apples that are not solely from the estate. And so it's a little bit less expensive because some of these ciders can get up to, you know, $20 a bottle if you want to get serious about it.
So I have to ask, since it's basically so simple to do, is this something a home brewer could do?
Well, it's a really great question. Certainly one could. There's no question about that. But I think it's that complexity that's derived from a diversity of apple trees. As I say, even sometimes pear trees are allowed to be included.
And I like that thought really well.
Yeah, there are about 300 to 400 different types of apples that are grown in Brittany that are utilized to make cider. Almost the same number is true in England for some of their complex ciders as well. So unless you have a very diverse orchard, it's hard to make something that has this much stuff going on. And you have to be patient and you have to be very clean about it, even though this one is funky. In their own way, they're clean. I mean, this is probably the product of wild yeast, or at least partially of wild yeast. Mm-hmm. That's to say, you didn't just select the yeast. You let the fermentation stay open to the air, but you have to know when it's time to close it off, get it in a barrel, often really old barrels, and let it sit for 6 months or so.
Is it true of ciders, Doug, all ciders, that there are multiple different kinds of apples rather than just one?
Not necessarily. What we're seeing in the U.S. these days are people who are saying, oh, I make only a Macintosh cider. Mm-hmm. And I always think, you need to study more about cider, because that's what makes it interesting, is when we put all these different bitters and sours and sweets together. So traditionally, yes, that's true, David. But what we're seeing now are people thinking that there's some marketing advantage to be conferred by picking apples that we know.
Right.
And I'm guessing that, unlike a wine where sometimes the shape of the glass can help in the tasting experience, with cider we don't necessarily have that concern?
Actually, I'm using a wine glass because I think this is a complex enough cider that I find it really interesting. But you're absolutely right. Most of the time you get something that looks more like an ale glass than anything else. But I'm kind of, you know, I'm a geeky guy. I got to put it in the wine glass and sniff it and swirl it and play with it and stuff.
Well, I kind of like the fact that the bubbles are really lasting on this, on the top of it. So it's got a little bit of the bubbly to it, too, I think, Lisa.
Mm-hmm. No, it's like I said, I'm a happy lady. You've picked one for me.
Well, we know it was lively because when I opened it, we had a small accident.
Yes, it's true.
Doug's good with a bar towel, folks.
Yeah, we're going to be having to clean the carpet in here.
It's all true.
We'll just let it air out for a very, very, very long time. So was this something that also was first developed across, or did people naturally start to make it over here without the aid of anything from Europe or other lands?
I think that it's true of humans that, generally speaking, they are desperate to make some sort of alcohol beverage. And what's interesting is that the Indians of Northeast New England, present-day New England, seemed not to have any alcohol beverage, which makes them nearly unique within the peoples of the Western Hemisphere, because most everybody else could make it from corn, make it from maize, make it from fruits, all sorts of things that they could make their alcohol beverages from. So when the Pilgrims and other people arrived, they certainly tried to bring cuttings and tried to make wine. They certainly grew beer, but grew wheat and barley and other grains. They didn't use corn because that was only for animals, but they knew how to make cider. In fact, they knew how to make applejack, a rudimentary kind of applejack, because you would make a lot of cider, then you leave it outside to freeze, and the water freezes and the alcohol doesn't, because it takes a much colder temperature to freeze the alcohol. The bad part about that is it also doesn't freeze the methanol, so they had another word for that applejack, and they called it skull pop. So, and that's not a nice thing. That's a, it hurt. It hurt your head to drink it. But they would make it however they could. But yes, cider, everybody who came over from the current day British Isles knew how to make cider, and they set to making an alcohol beverage, not just because it has alcohol in it, not just because it gives you a way to drink a healthful liquid, also because it endures over the winter. It endures even often into the summer. So it gives you nutrition even when you're having trouble growing other things.
It seems like ciders in this country have really gained in popularity in the last few years.
It's nuts. In the last 5 years, we basically doubled our cider numbers every single year.
Yeah. Literally so, walked into an area tavern and, what wasn't there, and all of a sudden it was there, and there, several taps now.
Yeah, indeed, beer producers are sort of scratching their heads saying, what happened? I was getting all this love, and now I have to give up my handles for a bunch of ciders. But, we Americans are very fickle, and it's a kind of a new, cool thing. And I think it does speak to this gluten-free idea, people's ideas of healthful living. And it also theoretically speaks to local or regional. And, that's at the heart of this whole conversation about Thanksgiving and holiday foods, is this notion of local. and how local can be different than regional,
as
came
up
earlier.
There's a tremendous number of orchards in this area. Do we have any local producers of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Lewisburg Cider Mills is, you know, a strong tradition in this area. So,
do they make a cider?
Well, they make non-alcoholic cider.
Oh, I was going to say, no, I'm talking about
the stuff you and I want to drink.
Yeah. No, don't get me wrong. Used to make a yearly trip down there, too. Had to get cider donuts.
Are there any Missouri ciders?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure. I know there's some in central Missouri. I'm not sure if there's anybody in this area. So maybe somebody will call in and
give us a shout. I was going to say, maybe our listeners can give us a help there. If you know of a locally produced or area-produced cider, please give us a call, 816-235-2888, and we'll get you on air. So I wanted to ask... Oh, we have one more. Oh, well, then I'll let you pour while I ask the question. I know you can do two things at once, Doug. I have great faith in you, my friend.
Thank you, Danny.
That what has been some of the most recent immigrants in wines to this hemisphere, or even to, if they've come up from South America, to North America?
It's been very interesting. Certainly a great deal of the seeing in the U.S. is from Africa. And Africans have their own heritages of alcohol beverages, but a lot of those are pretty rudimentary maize beers and mm-hmm. banana gin. Actually, that's a big thing. Banana gin? Yeah, you make it out of bananas.
You're kidding.
No, it's not very good. But
it sounds gross.
It's the ingenuity of Africans, humans will make alcohol out of anything we can.
So just very quickly, because we have our last entry in front of us, what is this that we're looking at now?
We're having Christmas beer. Christmas ales, Christmas beers, those sorts of things have become a tradition now over the last decade or two for most breweries. Most breweries try to make one. This is Breckenridge's. They're usually heavy. They're usually spiced, seasoned, flavored in some way. You know, coriander and cinnamon and allspice and clove and things like that are very common, sometimes fruit peel. But they are much similar to the glug or the glühweins or the wine or beer or whatever celebrations that we have in the holidays when we take all these wonderful aromatic spices. In other words, we show off all the stuff that we have. We throw it all together. We make something as rich as we can and decadent as we can possibly make it, much like the Thanksgiving table. And at least, you know, for that season, we say life is good.
Well, while you guys take a quick taste, I'm going to take a quick call from Brian in Lee Summit. Brian, welcome to Up to Date. What news do you have for us?
Stevenson's is still selling cider in the grocery stores, even though the restaurant is no longer in business.
Is it a hard cider or is it a non-alcoholic cider?
Oh, no, this is just a regular cider.
It makes a pretty wonderful combo with a little bit of whiskey.
Can we go. A little secret. Brian, thanks for the information.
Thanks, Brian.
So, real quick, let's go around the table. And David, your thoughts on this?
I really love the label.
Okay, that's
it's really cute.
I think that's that's diplomatic.
Yes, I'm not a beer fan in general. This is, but it's. I've been to the Breckenridge Brewery. It's a it's a nice beer. I don't have anything to dog on it.
Or Lisa,
it's great.
I like it as well. I like Christmas beers. I like Boulevard's Nutcracker. And to me, this is perfect because to me, Thanksgiving means that Christmas is just around the corner. and I do love the Christmas spirit. I'm a little elf over here. So this fits for me.
I find it incredibly smooth. Peggy?
It's very smooth. It's very, like you say, they kind of threw all the spices in, it seems like, Doug. And it's kind of Christmas in a glass. And it might be something to raise when you're putting up your Christmas tree.
Christmas in a glass.
And I guess there you can say there could sometimes there's a little bit of danger when you throw everything in, of having a distinctive note. I don't think this has anything particularly distinctive about it, but it is a very smooth and pleasant tasting beer. But is there a danger when they do that?
Oh, I think so. I think, you know, it can be done in a clumsy fashion. Anchor Steam has been making Christmas beer for, gosh, decades. And I used to be one of those guys that I would buy every vintage and then we would wait 10 years and we would drink, because you can actually age some beers. The truth of the matter is that we would, you know, sit down and then drink a 10-year-old Anchor Steam Christmas beer. And we would look at our notes and say, you know, that's very much like last year's Anchor Steam Christmas beer. In other words, they all started to kind of blend together when they're fresher and they're newer, then those vibrant notes would come out. And what made one distinctive from the next was more of obvious. So, yeah, I certainly think they can get muddled. But I think there's a world of flavors out there. And that's what's great. You know, greatly fun.
So I'm going to ask real quickly, Doug, what's going to be on your table this Thanksgiving?
Oh, as I say, I got some Germans teed up. We're probably going to be doing some Fritz Hock Spätlese's. So something that's a little bit sweet, but I think that people, as I said before, sort of misunderstand German Riesling. It starts sweet and it ends dry and tart, and that's what I think is fun about it. But that's just us, you know.
That's just us. I want to thank Doug Frost. He is a master sommelier and master of wine for joining us, as he does every year. It's a fine tradition, Doug. Thank you for keeping it up with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Also, Peggy Lowe, thank you for being here. David Folk and Lisa Rodriguez, KCOR staffers that, you know, somebody had to do it. Thank you all.
Too bad.
Thank you.
Okay, you can find all of our broadcasts at kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to follow KCUR and on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. Tomorrow, we'll talk with local Islamic leaders about ISIS, Islamophobia, and what it's like to be Muslim in Kansas City. Our program is produced by Lisa Rodriguez, Beth Lipoff, and Taylor Johnson. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Danny Alexander, and you are up to date.